Well, my name is Ray Galvin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a very opinionated man. Everything I say here is my opinion. And my opinions are very important to me because they keep me sober. They may not do a lot for you, but they do a lot for me. And none of my opinions are chiseled in stone. So if I should say something here that is contrary to the way you work your program or the way your sponsor wants you to work the program, then you just write me off as a zero and you go to another meeting, a midnight meeting if possible, and or one early in the morning. And for those of you that are new, I want to assure you that because I'm going to take up the rest of the meeting talking about myself and talking about AA, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm an authority on AA or I'm an authority on alcoholism. If you've read some of the pamphlets and you talk to the other alcoholics of some length, then you know as much about AA as I know. The only thing I may know more about, if I preceded you here, that I probably know more about Ray Galvin than you know about you, because I've had 32 years on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out who I am, and what I'm doing about it. And it suggested that we tell each other what we like, what happened, and what we're like today. And I want to stick strictly to that format, but I'm not going to take you on any kind of a drunkologue, I promise you that. But I think it's necessary that I highlight my behavior as a practicing alcoholic in the event that there is a Ray Galvin out there that hasn't yet been able to identify with anyone else. And I'm going to start at the beginning. Now, I don't believe that I was born angry. I really don't believe so, but I believe I was born alcoholic. And my earliest recollections was of anger and anxiety and the knot in my stomach. And my mother tried all the patent medicines trying to fatten me up, and nothing seemed to work. Until one day an old Irish lady came to my mother and she said, "Nellie," she said, "there's only one thing in the world that's going to put a flesh on that boy's body, and it's a glass of sherry wine every morning with a raw egg in it." And my mother went out and bought a bottle of sherry wine, and the next morning they came at me with this 8-ounce tumbler full of sherry wine with this rag dropped into it, and Jesus was a terrible looking mess, really a horrible looking mess. And they had to chase me around and hold me down just once. And I relate this incident in my life geographically. We lived in this house when I was between the ages of 7 and 9, so for argument's sake we'll say that I was just 8 years old. And although somebody was sitting on my chest, and I could feel that wine burning all the way down. And every time I tell a story, I get a residual feeling of that wine going all the way down. And it was a wondrous thing. And I get that relaxation in my arms. And it was the first time, if my memory serves me, that I actually felt relaxed. And that anxiety, that knot in my stomach, it was no longer there. And my mother kept this wine out on the back porch in an ice box, and I used to go out there and suck on a bottle. I never bothered with the egg, just a bottle. This one day, I guess I finished what remained in the bottle, or whatever happened. I drank too much and I passed out, and they cut off my supply. They put me to bed and cut off my, and I didn't gain an ounce. And I was a very poor student as well. I was left back in the fourth grade. I had a difficult time getting through school. And but I know that my body could have tolerated just a little bit of wine, going to school every morning, that I wouldn't have had any problems in the fourth grade, you see, because I'd have sat there and I would have been relaxed and I would have been receptive to anything was that they wanted to teach me. Well, you can't teach a child anything to sit there this way, you know. These little boys, I mean, and I'd wail into those kids for no reason at all. See? And that was kind of the story of my life. That the things that I couldn't understand and the things that I couldn't control, I went about smashing. And I smashed my way through life. I grew tall, and in 1940 I enlisted in the United States Army. And I enlisted September 9th of 1940, and I was discharged November 12th of 1945. And most of these were war years. And if you could stand up straight, and if you had a booming voice and you were left from right, the chances are they'd make you a lieutenant colonel, or at least a major. I enlisted enlisted as a private, and 62 months later I was discharged as a PFC. Now that takes care of those 5 years. I don't have to go into all the lower details about that. just to tell you that I was made broken 13 times before I wound up in Europe. And I was an infantry soldier, and I drank a lot in Europe. I really did. I drank all of the Calvados I got to get my hands on, a cognac and buzz bomb fluid, anything I get my hand on. But I never misbehaved. I obeyed all of the orders. I never misbehaved, and I'm telling myself, today you are a man, you know. Boy, you're right up there, you're drinking, you're not getting in any trouble, and you're handling this booze real good. Well, I got home, but when I got home, you know, I was lonely. And those of us that are addicted, we know a loneliness that I've never met anyone eloquent enough to describe, you know. And that loneliness, and I was a fish out of water. And the things that I enjoyed doing, I could no longer do these things. And I drank every day. I wasn't drunk every day, but I had something to drink every day. And I wasn't drunk on an excursion. I punched my father out. On another drunk, I punched the wooden panels out of the doors of my mother's house. And on another drunk, I punched holes in the plaster going up to my room on the third floor. They'd arranged a very lovely room for me in the third floor of my mother's house. You're just punching holes in plaster, you know. And long before I ever got to AA, I knew that when I took that first drink, I couldn't guarantee my behavior to anybody. And I knew that I was insane, totally, completely insane after I took that first drink. And I know the feeling of watching neighbors cross the street in the middle of the block when they saw me coming, because in that neighborhood they regarded me as an animal, and they just didn't want to take the time of day to bid me the time of day. They'd sooner cross the street in traffic. And one day a little guy stood right in front of me, called me a lush. He wasn't even related to me, called me a lush. But the contempt that I saw on this man's face would have stopped the freight train, really. He said to me, "You're a lush, you're a lush." And I stood there and I, you know, just looked at him. And he turned on his heel and walked away, and I thought to myself, well, it's true that I've been drinking too much, but it's my mother and my father and my creepy brother and all these bums that I'm doing business with around here. No wonder I'm getting drunk so often, you know. I've got to get out of here. I'm going to go to California. That's what I'm going to do, and it's going to be different out there. And I told someone, I suppose, I was coming out here to California, and whoever it was I told must have had a tremendous hatred against the city of Long Beach because they touted me on going there. And it was a destination, you know. I didn't know anything about Long Beach, but when they said Pacific, I figured it was on the beach, and it was as far west as I could come. And I arrived in Long Beach, and I was here but a very, very short time, and I bought a little beer bar. And it's still there. It's at 1515 South Street. And it was a nice little family-type operation when I bought it, and I immediately converted it into a sewer. And I really loved that little sewer. I really did. And but they told me also when I took possession of the bar that this was 3.2 beer, and I couldn't have any hard liquor on the premises at all. And the 3.2 beer I wasn't going to drink any of it anyway. And I said, I'm going to lay a little private stock. So I got a whole little Clark's bottle, and I cleaned it out, and I filled it full of VO, and I kept it under my sink. And I had some customers there that I trusted. I didn't particularly like them, but I trusted them. And I was selling them this good Canadian VO and Canadian booze and serving it to them in a coffee cup. And I'm really shocking to you, because it was shocking to me when these people objected to drinking this good Canadian booze out of a coffee cup, and I'd have drank Sterno out of a rubber boot, and these people are complaining, you know. So this guy said to me this day, he said, "You know, Galvin," he said, "I do enjoy coming in here." He said, "But I just can't cut this coffee cup anymore." He said, "There's no law against having fruit juices in a beer bar." He said, "So lay in some fruit juice and some vodka, and we can drink what looked like an orangeade out of a glass." He said, "How about that?" I said, "Well, I think that's a grand idea." And I didn't know where to keep my vodka, because you can't have a bottle of light and dark Clorox under your sink. But anyway, my little Irish brain went to work, and I went downtown and I bought an aquarium, a 5-gallon aquarium. And I cleaned it out, and I put gravel in, put ceramic cast in, put some plastic prints in, set it up next to my cash register, and I was off and running, off and running. And, you know, I have the right to stand here and tell you that I am an alcoholic. I have that right. I had the right to say that you are, or he is, or she is, or they. I don't have that right at all. Well, I had a relic from World War I working for me. You know, I don't have the right. God forgive me. Pete was an alcoholic. And I didn't tell Pete what I had in my aquarium or in the Clorox bottle. And I didn't care how much of that 3.2 stuff he drank in the mornings. But anyway, I've been partying for about 2 or 3 days. I had like all outdoors. And I went to the bar and I went to my register. Jesus, I saw angelfish floating around in my vodka. And I thought, Christ, I've got the DTs, you know. But it was a great disappointment to me, because when I wanted to get the DTs, I wanted things coming out of the wall, at the up out of the floor, not stinking little fish in a bowl, you know. But anyway, I put my hand in, I came up, and I had a dead fish right there. And I said, Pete, where do these fish come from? He said, well, Ann saw the tank race. He said, she brought the fish down. He said, but I should have changed the water. He said, because I know someone put them in. He said, they went to the bottom and came up dead. So I said, Pete, look at me. Look at me, Pete. I said, I'm going in 9 different directions. 9 different directions, Pete. I said, I'm a nervous wreck. My nerves are shattered. Don't put any fish in there. I can't stand all that activity in there with the fish doing all that. Please, don't put any fish in there. Whatever you do, for God's sakes, keep the fish out of there. And if you ever change the water, I'm going to kill you. Now, this is a very tiny bar, a very, very tiny bar. And all things being relative, I stole a lot of money in that bar. And all things being relative, I made a decent living there, too. And I didn't get to sell it. I lost it. But before I lost it, I had to digress a moment and tell you that my religious training began and ended at the baptismal font. And of all the horrendous things that I got myself into in my lifetime and came through relatively unscathed, I don't ever remember saying thank God. I don't remember saying it, you know. The only prayer I knew was, phew, Jesus, you know. Phew, Jesus. Maybe some of you have prayed that way, I don't know. But it was enough for me. I guess it was my higher power accepted that, you know, Jesus, you know. But if you keep that in mind, then I'll tell you how I lost the bar. A man by the name of Frazier came in, and I always mention his name, hoping I'm breaking his anonymity, because if I am, he means he's not a problem of Alcoholics Anonymous. But Mr. Frazier came in, and he was looking for trouble. He wanted trouble with me in particular. And I walked out from behind the bar, but I, honest to God, I didn't go out there to fight him. I just went out to get him out. And as I approached Mr. Frazier, he threw a punch at me. Now, I saw this punch coming, and I could have slipped the punch. I'd done a number of things, but a little voice speaking to me in the privacy of my mind said, catch this one, catch this one. And I stuck my chin out, he landed the first blow, the fight was on. And Mr. Frazier was seriously hurt, and I was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon and thrown into the old Long Beach jail. And I've been in jails before, and a jail is a jail is a jail, and one is as good or as bad as the next. But this particular time, I was very frightened. I had a very uncertain future. And I think the seed of decency that we are all born with germinated in me that day, you know. But anyway, not to get more than about it, but Mr. at my trial, Mr. Frazier admitted punching me first, and the jury acquitted me. But because of the notoriety and because of the expense of the trial, and the state wasn't going to renew my license anyway, I just had to turn a key in that little gold mine and walk away from it. Pardon me. And I had a difficult time finding employment. But I finally got a job as an automobile salesman at 929 American Avenue. And we're getting pretty close to a recovery here. Don't lose faith. And I was standing outside the showroom, and two guys were moving furniture upstairs. I said, "So the salesman, who was moving in up there?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "A bunch of drunks." He said, "I got mad at that AAAAA thing." He said, "They're starting their own drunken society." And I guess I put it here. No smart remarks, nothing. And he says, "Oh yeah." He said, "What do they call it now?" He says, "Yeah." He said, "They call it the 12-step house." And I said, oh, that was it. Well, sometime after that, there was a strand of bars in Dominguez, and I was doing my thing. And drunk or sober, I was an unpleasant human being to be around. And I'd sit in these bars, and I'd grind my teeth, just grind them. And I had people crawling walls, you know. And I just wanted somebody to come up and tell me stop grinding your teeth, and that's the kind of guy I was. But anyway, this particular night, I really don't know what happened. Whether I got to look at myself in the mirror or not, I don't know. But suddenly I was fed up to here with Ray Galvin. And I got off that stool, and I knew where I was going, but I didn't know to whom. And it didn't matter to me. Somehow, instinctively, intuitively, I knew that this was the beginning of something and also the end of something. Now, I don't know how I knew it, and I'm not a quick brain by any stretch of the imagination, but I knew it. And I got out to my car, and I backed out of the parking space. I put my foot on the brake, and it went right to the floor. All the fluid had drained out of the master cylinder. And the only braking equipment I had was under the dashboard on the left. And I had quite a distance to drive, and I was in that condition. It was a Saturday night, and my higher power was looking out for you and looking out for me. Because I arrived at 929 American Avenue without so much as a close call, not even an incident. And it was a long flight of stairs, and there was a door ajar. And I just walked in, and these guys sitting around the round table, and they were laughing and giggling. And I said, I thought I intruded into somebody's apartment. I turned to leave. And this guy said, can I help you? And I said, well, he said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, I do. He said, sit down. And I sat down, and they talked to me, and I talked to them, and I told him about a ride in there without a break. And this man said to me, he said, you know, every Sunday morning here, he said, the 12-step house, he said, we have a meeting. Would you like to go? And I said, indeed I would. I said, I think that would be just grand. And he said, all right, I'll tell you what you're going to do. You leave your car downstairs tonight. He said, Bill Jennings will drive you home. He'll take you to the meeting, and after the meeting, tomorrow morning, you can have your car fixed. How about that? And I agreed to that, and I arrived at my first AA meeting, a very, very small meeting. And when I walked in, I noticed this guy right over, a very handsome man, very intelligent looking, and he kind of oozed culture. And I thought, maybe this guy's a mayor here or something. You know, he has to own the building or something, you know. So but, as it turned out, he was a leader. And he got up there, he rapped water, everybody quieted down. And this very intelligent guy said, hello, everybody. He said, my name is Dale. He said, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh, Jesus, how can anybody that looks that sharp stand up in front of all of these people and say a terrible thing like that? And I said, tune that bum out, because all the Moose, the Elks, the Knights of Columbus, all the veterans groups, they have dinglings, I said. So I tuned him out, didn't hear a thing he said. A little while later, a lovely lady walked up front. She picked up a book. And she said, hello, everybody. She said, my name is Jane. She said, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh, Jesus, this is his sister, and this is a congenital defect, and the group is being nice to them. And I said, tune her out, because they have ding-a-ling ladies, and all the ladies' auxiliaries, they have ding-a-lings too. You know, I did hear a thing she read. But this is a participation meeting, and everybody that participated thereafter identified themselves and qualified themselves as alcoholic. And all it was appalling to me to hear the first two people publicly admit that they were out. Boy, that was a big word, you know. But I hung my head out the window that morning and said, hey, my name is Ray Galvin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm about as anonymous as the Harvard Pier. Now, I'll protect my anonymity and your anonymity where the traditions say I must. But when I'm with you, my name is Ray Galvin, and I'm an alcoholic. An alcoholic. And everybody that participated at that meeting that day said, you want to stay sober, you've got to go to meetings, 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 meetings. You want peace of mind and contentment, you've got to go to meetings. You understand that? Meetings, meetings, meetings. That afternoon I went to a meeting at the Alano Club. And that was a participation meeting. And everybody participated at that meeting said, you want to go, you want to stay sober, you've got to go to meetings, 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 meetings. You want peace of mind and contentment, you've got to go to meetings, meetings, meetings. You understand that? Meetings, meetings, meetings. That night I went to a meeting in Westminster. And a man by the name of Lee Montoya was a speaker. And Lee looked down, and I know he was looking at me. He said, you want to stay sober, Slim? He said, you got to go to meetings, 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 meetings. You want peace of mind? I got 10 minutes, Slim, you got to go to meetings. And I loved the meetings, because I was, one of my opening remarks is that I never felt comfortable with myself. There was an anger. I was born with an anger, and I didn't fit into my own skin. I wasn't comfortable any place, anywhere, with anybody until I got to AA. And I rushed to these meetings because not so much of what I was going to hear, but what I was going to feel. What I was going to feel. I was beginning to fit better in my skin, you know. And I was leaving there with a better opinion of Ray Galvin. I liked Ray Galvin a modicum more than when I walked in, you see. So I rushed to these meetings. But I resented this fact. You got to go to meetings, 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 meetings. I said, why can't I read the big book? Why can't I review a meeting in my mind, you know? Why you jam this down my throat, but I kept going? And now I'll tell you, in my opinion, why it's so necessary to go to meetings. Because here in AA you're going to have God, you're probably going to find God's greatest creation. And that's the love that we have here. Now this is a different kind of love entirely. It's an undemanding love and an uncompromising love. If you stayed in AA for 1,000 years, it couldn't compromise you for 30 seconds. And the love, you know, the love is absolutely magnificent. Magnificent. It's God-given, this love. And we demand nothing of you. Demand absolutely nothing. We don't demand that you stop drinking and using. At least I don't. If you want to drink and you want to use, that's your business. That's your business. Not mine. So drink and use. But you want to stop using, and you come up here, and if you tell me that you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you've made it my business. And when you make it my business, I'm going to make your life miserable. You don't have to call me. I'll call you. I'll call you. I'll find out where you are. I'll find out where you are. You don't have to call me. You've made it my business. You've made it my business. So unless you don't want that a wild-eyed Irishman following you around town, ripping you off of bar stools, then just don't tell me that you want what we have. You know. Now, for whatever reason, you brought your bones to this meeting tonight. You know, whether it was to because a judge sent you with one of those get-well cards, or you're here to save a job, or save a marriage, or for whatever reason, you know. You're here because you're a troubled human being. Or I'm polite with you when they're saying that you're troubled. And with me, I'm an open wound. Even after 32 years on this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, in some areas of my life, I am an open wound. And it's perfectly all right with me. I don't ever expect to heal. I don't really try to heal up, you know, because I have the perfect antidote against any of the things that are going to make me get drunk again, you know, the knot in the stomach and this violence and this anger. If any of those things even start to creep up on me, I go to you. And you don't have to be sober 30 years. You don't even have to be sober 30 days. If you've been around long enough to hold me by the hand, look at my eye, and tell me that it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right, you know. There aren't that many questions here in AA. And I know all the answers. After 32 years, I don't know the answers, and I haven't been listening. I know the answers. And I know what you're going to tell me, but I need that reaffirmation. I need the warmth of your hands and the love in your eye. I need that. And believe me, I've had to go to those of you out there on several occasions, you know. And you held my hand and you looked in my eye and told me it was going to be all right. And I knew it was going to be all right. And I walked away feeling better. Feeling better. This is not a brand new disease that we have here, this disease of alcoholism. I believe that from the time that they crushed the first grape, when the first grape was crushed and the juice was permitted to ferment to our alcoholics right from that very, very first grape, there was probably an alcoholic under it, you know, when they crushed that first grape. And those alcoholics were no different than any of us in this room or any of us that have gone beyond. They were good, decent, wholesome human beings as you are. And they had a disease that no one knew anything about. And they were thrown into dungeons. Their families had nothing to do with them. They were treated less than the farm animals. And left to die alone. Left to die alone. And 53 years ago, come this June, two men got together in Akron, Ohio. And from that, we have this magnificent lovership going on. And now around the world, even in Russia, some people from Dallas, Reddings, and Long Beach have gone to Russia to start these AA meetings. So around the world, for every second of every minute, hour, day, week, month, year, there are meetings going on. Around the world, AA meetings. So just imagine the energies going into this thing around the world. So how can you miss? If you're sitting here and you hate what you're hearing from me, you don't like your surroundings, and you hate being in crowds, keep coming back anyway, because it's here, just by osmosis. And you can be openly contemptuous of us. You don't have to like us. We don't ask you to like us. You see? Just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. Again, you know, I believe that the first alcoholics weren't probably even human beings. And I'll tell you why I believe that. When I was in the Army, we were on maneuvers in Tennessee or Georgia or something like that, and I had a country kid with me, and we heard these terrible sounds at night. And I said to this kid, I said, what the hell is that? He said, they're drunken pigs. And I said, what? He said, they're drunken pigs. I said, what do you mean, drunken pigs? He said, there has to be a silo around here. He said, you know, they pour corn into the top of the silo. It crushes the corn on the bottom. The juices pour out, form a pool, ferment, and the pigs drink it and get drunk. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. I said, come on, let's go find that pool. Now, you never saw a drunk the way I had to kick that. That 400-pound sow I had to kick out of the way was the drunkest human thing, the drunkest thing I've ever seen in my life. I had to kick her out of the way, and I got that canteen cup in there, and I took a drink of this, and it was instant paralysis, you know. And I handed it to the kid, and his eyeballs changed. Socrates. And I said to him, don't tell anybody about that. I wanted to keep all of that rotten stuff to myself, you see. All of it. Now, I'm not going to linger with a lot of that. There's a few things I want to say. The people that I enjoyed and admired the most when I came here were those people that get up here and say, I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand them. And these people seem to walk about 4 feet off the ground. Their giving was an effortless act. They handled situations so gracefully. You know, they life was a joy to them, you know. And boy, I wanted that. I wanted life to be a joy to me, you know. And I figured if God was going to give it me, I'd go to any length to get that. But I knew I'd get up here, and I knew I could say, I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. But unless I actually felt it inside, that I wasn't impressing you, and my words is just vibrating themselves into oblivion. I had to have the feeling. I needed to have the feeling. And one night a little lady walked up front and she said, I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And I believed her. And suddenly I thought, oh boy, you believe that she believes. You know, you have faith in her faith. And that was a wondrous thing to me. A wondrous thing. And every meeting that I go to thereafter, I would suddenly pray that someone would get up here and say that they had turned their will and their life over to the care of God as they understand them. Because I had another coattail to hang on to. And through the years, I've hung at the thousands and thousands and thousands of coattails. And now I like to hear it, but I no longer have to hang on to the coattail. Because I have a faith of my own, and I have a very lenient higher power. My higher power doesn't demand great and noble deeds from me. He doesn't. I know my higher power remembers me as a very strange little boy. And he remembers me for whatever it was I was in Europe, but that was something else too. And he remembers me when I came home. And he's probably saying to himself, this is as good as this bum is ever going to get. Don't look at a gift horse in the mouth, you know. And I know that my higher power approves of me because he's so very, very good to me. Very, very good to me. And it would be immodest of me to stand here and tell you of all the wondrous things that he's given me. And I'll say this to you newcomers, that just, you know, when you sober up, don't limit yourself. Don't limit yourself. You're the last ones to know what magnificence there is inside of you. This, probably the thing that created you to become an addict of anything was this unrequited fire that's going on, this talent, this energy, this skill going on inside of you, and it's unrequited. And here you're going to find a forum. And if you just let life happen to you, just sit here and let life happen to you. It's like reading a book. You take it one page at a time, you see. So just hang in there. Hang in there. And be your own friend, you know. And you have to be your own friend. And if there's anybody out there that's having a problem with the spiritual aspect of this program, if you want to, I'd like to make a deal with you. If you come up to me at the end of this meeting, you tell me that you don't believe. Well, you come right on up and you tell me that you don't believe, because I'm going to believe that you don't believe. But when you come on up and you tell me that you don't believe, and you want me to believe that you don't believe, because I'm going to believe that you don't believe, you better be prepared that I believe when I tell you. And that's fair, isn't it? When you tell me that, and then you better believe when I tell you that I believe. And every time you hear somebody say, I believe, just believe it and forget it. But don't make a big megillah of it. And don't look for God in high places. Look, for all the godlike qualities in yourselves, the theologians on the program tell me that we were born in His image. You see, the godlike qualities. You know, the essence, the epitome of spirituality, in my opinion, is one of God's kids helping another one of God's kids. God's kids helping another one of God. For fun and for free, God's kids are helping another one of God's kids all around the world in the AA meetings. That's the name of this love that we have here. God's kids helping another one of God's kids for fun and for free. You see? So, you're spiritual. If if you're sitting out there and this is your initial contact with AA, and you're sitting there and you're saying, I haven't helped anybody, you're as spiritual as anybody in here. You helped the most important one in here. You help yourself, and you're one of God's kids. And you're one of God's kids. And you're magnificent. You're a good, decent, wholesome human being. And you have a disease called alcoholism. A disease called alcoholism. And it's got so many of us together. It's such a wonderful thing. Yeah. And don't ever think that everybody else out there is normal. I don't know what normal is, but don't even you probably think that you're the only one that has something. That's nonsense. Everybody out there has something. And their something is really something. It's something that I don't want anything to do with their something because they have no place to bring their something. I have a something. I can bring my something to you because you have the same something. And but those little creatures out there, man, they're swimming up they're swimming against the tide, really. So feel sorry for them, and then just be delighted that you are what you are, that you're an alcoholic, and you have a foxhole, a bomb shelter, a loving place. You see, that you have a loving place. Now, gonna get on with this. When I really got comfortable in my own skin, then I got a freedom, a great freedom. And where I was bound up before, I was never, and I got out here and I liked Ray Galvin, and I'm a pretty good dancer, and I used to go down to the Atlanta Club and for those days you get 6 songs for a quarter. I put a quarter in and get up there jazzing around him, and all those gray heads are going crazy. Who is he? Is he alcoholic? Where did he come from? And this one day, this guy had the temerity to say to me, "When are you going to mature?" And I didn't know what this guy was talking about. I had absolutely no idea. See? But I had matured a little bit, and I didn't realize it until this little thing happened to me. I'll tell you about it, and then I'm going to sit down. I left the rehearsal one night, and the guy said to me, "Will you drive me home?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "Let's get a bite to eat." And I said, "All right." And we stopped at this restaurant. We both ordered hamburgers. Now, the hamburger was served on an open-faced bun. And the meat patty was about that big. About as big as my watch, I guess, And we both reacted to it. Now, my friend is normal. I don't know what normal is, but he was an alcoholic. And his reaction was very vocal. And he looked, and he said, "God damn it, that's a little piece of meat!" And now my reaction, although I didn't say anything, but my reaction was, "God damn, that's a big bun." Now this guy created a scene of it. He didn't want to pay. I didn't mind paying for it, He left there hungry. I was full of bread, but I wasn't hungry, And all the way to his house, he's screaming, clicking his teeth together about this little piece of meat. And I'm thinking to myself, "Boy, am I glad I'm an alcoholic, and am I glad I belong to AA." And I dropped him off in front of his house, and I had quite a distance to drive to my own. And I started to analyze this thing now. Why did we both react so differently? And the knees were pretty big buns, you see, and they had sesame seeds on them, and a delicious dressing, and a kosher pickle. I love those things. A couple of carrots all curled up. What there was of the meat was delicious. The buns were fresh. The coffee was good. They offered us more coffee. The plate was clean. And I said to myself, "Geez, on a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you learn to look at the whole picture." Now my friend, my normal friend, he had tunnel vision. The only thing he could see was that stinking little piece of meat, the thing that was making him screw himself into the ceiling. That was all he could see. Yeah. so after the shock of that wore off, I said to myself, well, now, I wonder, do I do this in every aspect of my life, or just where Hannah was a concern, you know? And I really thought about that. And I thought for a long time, you know. And I concluded that about 80 or 85% of the time my waking time, I'm looking at the whole picture. And when I look at the whole picture of my life, believe me, I live in a magnificent world. A magnificent world. It's warm, there's music in it, there's excitement in it. I have friends that are here. Good time, there's too many to mention, really. I have that warmth, you know. And I've taken the time to ask myself, how well do I love? You see, how well do I love? And believe me, I love you all very, very much. And I know that you don't know how much, but I do. I do. I'll go to any length, if it was possible for me, to turn myself inside out and give you 30 days of my contentment and my sobriety. I'd take your misery. I think I could handle it for 30 days. But I'd do it if it was possible. If it was possible. Well, the light is on and I might as well go home. But I want you to know, I like Ray Galvin a lot. I do. I like me a whole bunch. But I love all of you. Thank all of you. And God bless all of you.